Okay. So, I think you all remember that I'm Kim Allen, and this is a continuation, this talk of what I talked about last week. But if you weren't here last week, don't despair. I'm going to start with kind of a recap and summary, and then we'll move on. And it's okay if you didn't hear the earlier part. So what we're talking about is kama or karma and the end of karma. That was the official title. But then I said that the sort of playful title was, what are we doing? What are we doing? Because karma is a word that just means action. It is what we're doing. And so I wanted to say a little bit about the evolving picture that I started painting last time about the Buddha's teachings on how action works, how it is that what we do has real effects in our life and how that lawfulness unfolds, if you will. So starting with the basics, the Buddha taught that actions have results. And we might say, well, duh. But remember that at the time, not all teachers believed this. It wasn't necessarily obvious that the things that we do have a big impact, particularly on our own mind and physics and psychology, for example. And there were teachers who were teaching that actions didn't have effects, or that actions were predetermined. They'd already been set up like a clockwork universe, and we're just playing it out, or that it was all being controlled by a god, something like that. And we see variations on that today, and sometimes even in our own minds, in little areas, little corners of our mind, there are areas where we believe that our actions don't really matter, for example. So the Buddha said actions always matter. They always have results, and that's the karma, and then the result is called vipaka. So kama vipaka. And then the second main thing that he taught was that actions have results in line with the ethical quality behind the action. So if we had a wholesome, skillful intention, and our action was coming from a place of care or kindness or wisdom, then that tends to lead toward happiness. That will have a good result in some way. It doesn't mean we get the intended result, as we know, because it's complicated, but it will tend to produce happiness in the doer. We will feel better about actions that unfold that way. Whereas if we are acting from a place of greed or envy or ill will or delusion, that will tend to bring suffering to the person who is acting in that way. It's just how it works. So that was another thing that he suggested we look into, and that he said that's how it works, and we should check it for ourselves. And then finally, he said that actions can produce their results. When do they produce their results? They can produce them immediately, or sometime later in this life, or in some future life. So it's not limited to this lifetime only. And that we have a whole trail of actions coming from previous lifetimes behind us that is beginningless. A beginning can't be discerned, is what he said. So you don't have to buy into that entire philosophy because not all of that is checkable in our immediate experience. But that's the suggestion. And there's a kind of a nice, I think we can see, even in our immediate experience, that the effects of actions actually don't always occur right away. I mean, there is always some effect in the moment, whether or not we feel it. But there are some actions that ripen years later, right? Like we suddenly realize that something somebody told us years ago has actually been playing out in our life in some way, or we'll suddenly remember something from previously and find that it has an impact. Things like that. There'll be other examples as we go along. There's a wonderful verse that likens this process, to give you an image, of milk curdling. And it says, fresh milk does not curdle right away. And similarly, the actions that we do might, if we do an unwholesome action, we might think, I got away with it, but it curdles later. And we feel the effects at that time. I think it's a powerful image. So, at any given moment, what is going on? And this moment, you have several things going on. So there is some kind of vipaka arriving from the past in this moment. You don't have any choice about what that is. It could be from the previous moment, or it could be from longer ago than that. But something is arriving from the past into this moment. Similarly, we have our own mind's response in this moment to that. Maybe it was an ouch, maybe it was an ah, you know, whatever's arising, the mind is responding to that. And then there's also an immediate effect from that response. So there's kind of three things happening at one moment. And then in addition, there will be some effects being sent forward. You don't have to discern all this or figure it all out. I'm going to read a quote later about how you shouldn't even try to do all that. But the point, and the reason I'm saying this in a way that may sound confusing, is to point out that karma is complex. So we have stuff coming in from the past. We don't know how long ago. We have things arising in the present and also exerting their immediate effect in the present as well as into the future. And then we have other people's karma interacting with ours, right? I've got my mind stream flowing along and I'm talking to somebody and they've got their mind stream flowing along. So you can see that it's a complicated system. And that's why it's not obvious. That's why there were debates about how action actually works. If it were simple and obvious and linear and proportionate, everybody would get it. But it's a little complex. And so we have to do some discernment. But, let me also point out that some of you may have experience with sitting in meditation and having some thought or memory from long ago arise suddenly. Has anybody had that experience? Yeah. I see a lot of nods and hands. So that's an illustration of things having their effect sometime later or coming back at some time later because they haven't really been fully felt and completed. So, so it's complex. And the early tradition doesn't really have an exact theory about when and how things will appear, except that they will appear in line with their ethical quality and in a sort of proportion to how developed your mind is. Now, if the mind is very well developed through cultivating a lot of mindfulness, then the ill effects of bad karma are reduced and the wholesome effects of good karma are expanded. Whereas if the mind is totally undeveloped, you're totally scattered, you've never done any practice, you get more impact from harmful karma and you get less impact from beneficial karma. So we're helping ourselves a lot by practicing. And if at any given moment we are aware or awake, mindful, that creates some choice about how we are going to meet whatever's arising in this moment. I'm sure you've all observed that in your practice. That moment where somebody says something, and instead of shooting back the, you know, immediate response that comes to mind, we happen to be mindful at that moment and we think, maybe I won't say that this time. And what a glorious moment that is. And we think later, whew, you know. So mindfulness matters a lot. It changes the whole effect. If you had said that thing, things would unfold differently in your conversation or in your relationship. So mindfulness is a game changer. in terms of the unfolding of karma. And it's so simple, right? Not easy, but it's so simple to try to be mindful. So I want to read a quote from Ajahn Suchito's book, Karma and the End of Karma, which was mentioned in the last class. Thought it might be nice to hear some of it. So he says, there's a choice. Karma depends on mental volition, whether this be a carefully considered intention or a compulsive drive or a psychological reflex. Right at the heart of our conundrum is the fact that we're not always clear about what we're doing and why. Remember the title, What Are We Doing? We may be operating on automatic or with blurred or biased attention, but still attending to and moved along by the push of passion or habit. For many of us, the main problem is not deliberate evil intention, but action based either on confusion, inattention, or misunderstanding. Yeah? And so he goes on to conclude, we can at least choose to investigate karma. And that's where the turnaround begins. So even if you can't fix all the habits and you can't totally resolve all of your confusion at this moment, you could at least look at the karma and how it's arising and what action we're choosing to take. That's good enough. So we have, we have this system that we're operating within. And once we start to get a handle that that's what's happening, there's this continually unfolding of past conditions coming into the present, present conditions evolving into the future, we can start to have a chance of playing the game, playing in with that. So it's a sort of a looping interactive system that is very hard for us to understand completely. But we can nonetheless, I like to use the word play. We can play within it. So think about playing, if any of you have ever played a team sport of some kind, whether it be soccer or pickleball or baseball or something like that. At any given moment, you know, you can't see the whole field. You can't see what everybody's doing. But you can play along with where the ball is, and you can do the next thing that needs to be done, or you can play your position, something like that. It's sort of like that with karma. There's a lot going on. There's a whole game there, something. But I can do my best to not drop the ball when it comes to me, something like that. So we don't need to understand it all. And this is the quote I promised about that. This is from the Pali Canon, the words of the Buddha. These four imponderables are not to be speculated about. Whoever speculates about them would go mad and experience vexation. How about that? So which four? The Buddha range of the Buddhas, which means the range of powers that a Buddha has. The jhana range of one absorbed in jhana, meaning the range of powers that one has during deep concentration. Don't speculate about those things. Number three, the results of karma. And number four, speculation about the first moment or purpose of the cosmos. So karma is right up there with understanding the cosmos and understanding the mind of the Buddha. And, you know, so reminds us, whoever speculates about these things would go mad and experience vexation. So a complex analysis of like, why do I have a headache at this moment? Oh, it must be because of that thing I said last week, and then now it's coming back as bad karma in my head. I don't know. Or, you know, a little bit more seriously, you know, why do children have terrible things happen to them or something? Is that, you know, what is the karma of that? These sorts of things are not necessarily easy to speculate about, and it's complex and we don't know, but we can meet it and respond. If we have mindfulness and awareness, we can respond from an awake place with care, with wisdom, with compassion, with what's needed, without having to figure out all of the stuff. Nonetheless, it's even though we're not supposed to spend a lot of time speculating about it, I would remind us that it is lawful. So action and result are ethicized. Wholesome and unwholesome, skillful and unskillful, those do matter. Those do matter. It is lawful and actions do have effects. So I find this kind of handy, like reassuring. Okay, there is, Sylvia Boorstein once said, it may be awful, but it's lawful. So that can be handy at certain moments. And then also not to get too tangled up in the in it. So the lawfulness is also given an image in the teachings, which is I think quite understandable, which is that if you plant an apple seed, you don't know when the tree's going to grow, you don't know how high it's going to grow, you don't know if it's going to survive or whatever, but or what shape all the branches are going to have when it finally becomes an apple tree. But you can be guaranteed that it will produce apples, not mangoes. Everybody agree with that? And if you plant a mango seed, you're not going to get pears. You're going to get mangoes if the tree comes to fruit. So that's what the lawfulness means. Whereas the details about how all that comes about, we may not be able to predict exactly looking at a seed because it depends on a lot of other things, but it is going to eventually produce apples. So that's how it is we can think about karma. Okay, so now let's go on to some implications of all of this. And this notion of kama vipaka as a kind of an ongoing, interactive, an action and result, if you will, it points to a predicament of human life that the Buddha addressed in his spiritual teachings, which is that there is no final solution within this flow. Where does it end? How could it end? In that apple trees keep producing apples which have seeds in them, which fall to the ground and they produce more apple trees, and on it goes. And there's the weather, and there's people and so forth. So continually creating fresh karma just creates more stuff. There's no way to create nothing, if you will, in a direct way. So it can't really lead to resolution. You know, within the round of karma and the result, we don't ever reach the freedom that the Buddha was pointing to. That's not where it lies. Final peace, the end of suffering, doesn't occur there. Only insight is freeing, which is a different concept. So everything else is part of the round. So in Theravada understanding, in the early Buddhist teachings, we are bringing karma to an end. There is no freedom without karma coming to an end. But we have to somehow get off the wheel. We have to find something that is not stuck within that same cycle, the cyclic, cyclic, cyclic. And this is another area where the Buddha somewhat differed from other ideas at the time. Some people don't see the cycle as harmful. They're like, it'd be great to come back. I'd get to see my family and friends again. You'd also have to do middle school again. And, you know. All aging, illness, death, all that. So, I get it, but that's not, you know, it's not that the First Noble Truth does not say life is suffering. This isn't all terrible and we need to just get rid of it all. Of course not. That's not part of the teachings either. But if it really has been going on since beginningless time, and here you are again, and it's going to be again and again. And again, don't you feel a little tired just thinking about that? Yeah. So, some traditions don't see the wheel as harmful, imagining that somehow there's some freedom within this. And the Buddha says it doesn't work that way. You can even if you go up to heaven, that karma eventually runs out, and you'll wind up back here or somewhere lower. Who knows? There were other teachings also, like other traditions that imagined ways of getting off the wheel, like the Jains, for example, had the idea that you could do very little, and eventually run out your karma. So if you don't create anything fresh by being very careful not to think anything, do anything, say anything, eventually all the momentum of the karma you had before will run out and you'll reach the end. And the Buddha said, "No, I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way, because wanting to end karma is itself a mental action. There's a view there, and mental action is still action. So there's still karma associated with trying to do nothing. Trying to do nothing is a doing." So that didn't work. So again, this is the Buddha's view of all this, but he instead said, we can classify karma into different types. He said there's four types. There's bright karma with bright results. There's dark karma with dark results. There's mixed karma, mixed bright and dark, with mixed results. And then there's a special fourth kind that's called the kamma that leads to the end of kamma. That's interesting. So I think bright and dark are clear enough. And I actually think they're well named, because the bright kind is the wholesome karma, the skillful, the things that come from wisdom and love and compassion and patience and all sorts of good things. And they are literally bright. In my experience, when I'm acting in ways that are wholesome, my mind is clearer. It's easier to be mindful during those actions. It has even a vibrancy to it. When I'm when there's generosity, or when I'm doing things with my friends, or when I'm studying the suttas or something, there's this aliveness there that has a brightness to it. The mind feels fresh or open in a way. And then there's dark karma, which is, it has a heaviness to it. Dark karma, being the unwholesome karma, comes from hatred, comes from greed, comes from, these kinds of mind states. It's depressing, it's narrow, it's literally kind of tight and dark in the mind. If you have mindfulness, you'll see that the mind is just not as bright when it's in a mood like that. So when we're complaining or discouraged or anxious, then there's this darkness in the mind. And it also, this darkness in other teachings, it says that it obscures wisdom, which I have found to be true also. We're just not as wise when we're caught up in dark mind states. So, and then of course, there's the mixed karma. I know there's a lot of that going on too in our mind, where, like, for example, we're giving a gift, but we're kind of secretly hoping that the person will go into our debt and give us a gift back. Wouldn't that be nice? Something like that. So it's kind of good, but kind of has a little unskillfulness mixed in there. Philip Moffat says, if it weren't for mixed motivations, I'd have no motivations at all. So yeah, I think it's fair enough. And then that ends up having mixed results, right? Like some good comes, but maybe there's a little entanglement that comes from it also, or something. So that's all, I think, clear enough. But then there's this fourth kind, the karma that leads to the end of karma. Sometimes they say karma, sometimes they say kamma. They're the same. And so, helpfully, since that's not as obvious to us, the Buddha defines it very clearly, actually. He says, what is the karma that leads to the end of kamma? It is the Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. This is the karma that leads to the end of karma. Interesting, isn't it? So, and he even says this action is neither bright nor dark, but is karma that leads to the end of karma. So, studying the path and understanding, what that's about, it has a special quality to it. And it's a fair question at this point to say, well, what is meant by the end of karma? What is that? So he says that also. It's a kind of release. So again, from the suttas. And what is the cessation of kama? Whoever touches the release that comes from the cessation of bodily kama, verbal kama, and mental kama, this is called the cessation of kama. And then he reiterates, and what is the path of practice that leads to this cessation? Just this Noble Eightfold Path, etc. So there is a particular set of actions, some of them even including mental ones like view and intention, right? Verbal ones, wise speech, and then a bunch of things related to the body and other parts of the mind. There's a particular set of actions that support the release of karma, which it won't do just by itself. It doesn't do it just by itself. We have to actually take certain actions that will result in vipaka being released. It's kind of amazing. It's kind of amazing. So among all the different kinds of kama that we can create, the Buddha saw, oh, look, here is a thread among all the choices we have. Here's a special one that actually goes somewhere. Everything else goes in a circle, but here's one that goes somewhere. Like in a stream, a lot of the water is kind of flowing around. There are eddies that go in circles, and then they go down the river a little bit, and then they go in another circle. But there's a current in the middle. And the current, the water that's in the current, is going to go all the way to the ocean. It's a special thread that runs through the stream that is going all the way, if you will. So it's kind of like a clearing in the forest that we can follow and that actually goes somewhere. So there is a distinction then. This is now getting into pretty subtle teachings, but I encourage you to hang on and try to listen to this. There is a distinction between bright karma and karma that leads to the end of karma. So bright karma, which you should all do, it's all good, but it feels lovely. It nourishes the heart. This is the part that we need for healing, for self-improvement in general. If you're doing the path because you want to be a better person, that's great. It includes the four immeasurables, the Brahmaviharas of metta and compassion and mudita, appreciative joy, and upekkha, equanimity. And in meditation, we can construct states like mindfulness, like calm, tranquility, eventually samadhi, although that could be part of the Eightfold Path. So we have all these beautiful mind states. They're actually called beautiful in the texts. Kalyana can mean beautiful. That nourish the heart, uplift it, that actually make the mind more able to be wise, more likely to have insight. So please do wholesome karma. Don't say, oh, I only want the karma that ends karma. Do plenty of wholesome karma. They really run parallel a lot of the way, but there's this special kind of karma that leads to this release. And you may have experienced this. We can see it in meditation. For example, when the mind is in a state of, you're having a pretty peaceful period in your sit, and you do happen to just be pretty mindful for, some time. We've maybe had a sit like this, kind of amazing. And if something arises into that, that is an old memory or a little pain in the hip or something that the mind might normally grasp onto and do something with, have you ever seen something come in to that field of knowing and then just fade away? You didn't do anything. Where'd it go? I see some nods. Yeah. So this is the release of that karma. It came in. It was a vipaka coming in from the past. We don't touch it, but the mind is in a certain state that is whole, that is right, sama, right mindfulness, right concentration. And we don't do anything with it, and it just falls away. That is the end of that karma. It is done. That seed is never coming back. So I hope you know that when that happens. Other times, that memory arises, we pick it up, we say, what's wrong with it? How did that happen? So there we're creating more karma. We're letting that go on. So it's interesting, right? It's a different feeling and it feels clean. We feel that. And we have this also in everyday life. It doesn't just have to happen in meditation. There are acts of speech, for example, where we say something and we feel that it just settles out, or it flows so smoothly that the moment passes with no stickiness. Or we have a thought, you know, we're driving and we have a nice thought and we feel it just kind of open into the mind and blossom, and then it's the next moment, totally clean. That thought came and went and left no residue. So that's an example, a micro example of the ending of kama. And the Buddha says that we can experience that fully. You know, there can be a moment where everything all comes together and all of the suffering releases at once. It may come back the next moment, but there can be a deep understanding of what that release is. So this process of Dharma that we're doing is not just for stress reduction. It's creating conditions in the mind that can render a seed impotent, particularly the unwholesome ones. They could be gone. Now, that particular instance of anger may be gone, but there might be another instance of anger coming later. It's not that we ended it completely, but it's such a beautiful feeling to see. And we're only releasing the dukkha, you know. That's the only thing that really has to release. So, you know, when the mind walks this path and has enough of these moments, it really starts to lighten up and transform. And eventually it can transform permanently, such that, you know, no new karma will be created. And then we're just playing out anything that would be left coming through this body. That was what was happening to the Buddha between his awakening and his death. He wasn't creating any more productive karma. So this is a long process, but I felt it was important to point toward where, you know, the idea of where it's going and how we can experience many versions of that. Even on the first day of practice, we could have a moment like that. And then when we recognize them, they can continue to come. And the mind opens more and we're able to see more. And then there's more that we need to release. And then it keeps evolving, changing, flowing, opening, strengthening. Less greed, hatred, and delusion. But it's so beautiful along the way to feel that our patterns and our habits are lightening, and eventually maybe one or two of them have completely released, and you realize, I don't do that anymore. Where did that pattern go? So we're freeing the mind slowly. The Buddha spoke of a gradual training, which is the creation of bright karma and the creation of path, both together. And eventually, the mind releases all karma, even the bright karma. Don't need it anymore. You need it all the way up until the end. But at the last moment, you release even the bright karma in favor of the end of all of that. It's not esoteric. We can see it operating in our own life. And you don't have to try to figure it all out. I read that quote earlier, right? But we see it operating. I'm trying to point to very specific things that we may have seen. So this is the path. Ethical conduct, training of the mind, and development of wisdom. Three components. And every one of you has done some of it just to be here, just to sit through two talks on karma without screaming and running out of the room. You've done it. So I think we're left then with the question of the playful title I gave. What are we doing? What are you doing? Every moment we're conditioning our mind toward freedom or non-freedom. So the ability to choose non-suffering is the freedom that we gain. The ability to choose non-suffering. I heard that one also from Philip Moffat. I think it's quite concise. So I'll end there, and we have a few more minutes, 7 or 8 minutes, for any questions anyone might have. And it'd be great if you could use the microphone to ask so that it will get through to our folks online and